The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Wednesday, December 21st, 2016. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The sons of Donald Trump will not be raising millions of dollars for conservation causes. I ask you, who loses? The answer is conservation. The boys, not including Barron, the boys, Donald and Eric Jr., are avid outdoorsmen, seen here pictured atop the carcass of two majestic big cats in a spate of extreme conservation. The boys were shamed out of attending a gala where access to them and their dad, the president by then, and also a hunting trip with the guys would be sold off for $500,000 to $1 million, given, you know, if you're the grizzly level donor or an eagle level donor. Once news of this charitable endeavor got out, the Trump Organization chastised those who would question them, but also, due to the questioning, retreated from their obvious pay-to-play stance. Still, the boys, seen here holding up the chopped-off tail of an elephant, sorry, conserving the elephant's tail, were listed as honorary chairman for the event, still are, and the event still charging $1 million to be a bald eagle donor, and to meet with unnamed luminaries could be Toby Keith, who, by the way, could be running the NEA by January 21st. Now, the Trump C charity, not the actual D charity, the word charity, as a fact-free, get-out-of-trouble-free card. Ivanka was set to auction off a coffee with a top Trump confidant and advisor herself, meaning herself, for $50,000, but it was okay. It was for charity. On The Apprentice, Trump would always match celebrities' contributions to whatever charity they were giving to, but it was revealed during the election that Trump's charitable largesse was drawn from money provided by NBC. Trump's own charity is being investigated by the New York Attorney General. It can no longer raise funds. In fact, the foundation, the Trump Foundation, has already paid fines and admitted wrongdoing in a number of cases, including a political PAC connected to Pam Bondi, the former Florida Attorney General and an early Trump supporter. Charities cannot donate to PACs, and anyway, they named the wrong one. The charity paid a fine to the IRS for self-dealing. Self-dealing means a charity can't use charity's money to help themselves, their businesses, and families. In other words, you can't pay a fine from your charity. The Trump charity was doing that. And it wasn't until Trump was hounded by reporters he yelled at and clashed with, that he actually ponied up the bucks for the veterans that he raised in a debate boycott event. Don't mention the Clinton Foundation. Don't mention the Clinton Foundation. That's fine. I don't have to, because the Clinton Foundation's actually a real charity. The Clinton Foundation saved at least hundreds, most certainly thousands of lives, improved the lives of tens of thousands more. It's very highly rated in terms of accomplishment and efficiency, and every credible agency says it does a good job, and they're not the point. The important point here is how Trump uses charity. And the big question that I've been raising over and over again that the media needs to do a better job on is to ask the question, how does Trump get rich? Now, with the charity stuff, he's not getting rich, but it's illustrative. When the Trumps auction off access to themselves, and of course there is political capital to be gained in auctioning off access to themselves or somehow helping a big charity, because big charities often have powerful people behind them. But I'm putting that aside. That's called power. I'm not up in arms about that. But think about not the Trumps, but the donors. You're a donor, and you're asked to give big amounts of money to bend the ear of a president or his kids, who are also his advisors and run his business. If you give the money to the people themselves, you have violated the law. But if you give the money to a charity, it's all fine. To the donors, it doesn't matter. It's still a bribe. What do they care who gets the bribe? If the politicians would rather have the bribe go to a charity than to themselves, shouldn't make a bit of difference to the donors, because that is what we call pay to play. If the pay is to charity, it's not that much different than if the pay is to the politician, if the politician wants the pay to go to charity. Don't mention the Clinton Foundation. Except that was the exact accusation with the Clinton Foundation. Then it was an unproved accusation. In the Trump's case, it's there. TMZ has the facts. The Trumps think charity, saying, oh, it's all for charity, will blind the public or excuse themselves. But I suspect The reason that they backed off this pay-to-play charity endeavor is because it really didn't enrich themselves. So now let's ask the question, how does Trump get rich, and look at another similar area? This is an area where Trump stands to become personally enriched, and he is not backing off. Here is his choice for Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin on Fox Business a couple weeks ago.
We got to get Fannie and Freddie out of government ownership. It makes no sense that these are owned by the government and have been controlled by the government for as long as they have. In many cases, this displaces private lending in the mortgage markets.
Now, since those comments were made, shares of Freddie and Fannie have more than doubled. They've gone up about 150%. And guess who owns Fannie and Freddie? Donald Trump. Or he did in his one public filing. He has up to $5 million in a hedge fund which invests in Freddie and Fannie. He said he would be selling his individual stocks, but he and underlings have offered no proof that he's actually done that. We got to take him at his word. He didn't say anything about mutual funds, which I've talked about in the past. He didn't say anything about hedge funds. And he canceled a press conference last week in which he said he would offer details of his business holdings and conflict of interest. He is stonewalled on what he's actually doing through surrogates. So on a charity fundraiser, Trump shows he's willing to be cowed out of pay for play. On favoring policies that will personally enrich him, Trump has not answered questions and offers no proof of what his actual finances are. So that answers, how does Donald Trump make money off of this? But if the question is, who stole 11 days in Saudi Arabia? Well, the spiel suggests that a trip back in time to the 1750s might have some answers. The spiel meets timeless. But first, today, the star of, among other things, HBO's The Night Of. The character of Detective Dennis Box drove the action as we watched Riz Ahmed's character, Nazir, get worked over by the gears of justice. The system really was the antagonist, but Box was the very believable and in some ways even sympathetic face of that system. So I go face to face with actor Bill Camp, who's going to be in more projects in the upcoming year than you could drive a Zamboni over. This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Okay, let's begin with analogies. Sexy is to Ben Kingsley as fantastic is to Eddie Redmayne as 20,000 Phantoms is to Ray Harryhausen. You get the theme here. As subtle is to my next guest, Bill Camp, among many, many things, starred as Detective Box in the HBO series The Night Of. And I believe episode 2 took its title from a description of that character, a subtle beast. We were engaged in the bestiary. Hello, Bill. Good to see you.
Mike, good to see you.
So, did you glean any character insight from John Turturro's character describing you that way?
I had cheated already because I had read the script, so so I knew he was going to describe me that way.
But the moment you come across it, does something, a light bulb go off and say, okay, now
absolutely.
I get it.
Absolutely. It kind of fed me throughout the entire series.
Yeah.
You know, every scene that had to be shot and told was that description of Dennis Box was always in the back of my head in terms of how I was going to approach his interaction with whatever, you know, whoever he was talking with, or as he is often in that story, alone and thinking.
Right.
And trying to, you know, map out what actually happened in his own mind.
It must be really interesting, different, challenging, and great to have subtlety be the marching orders. I mean, it's right there in the script, and you're probably asked not to, or at least it's implied, go bigger, and it's like, I have to be subtle. You have to pick that up.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's something I should always remember.
Yeah.
You know, because I will go over the line, or I will do, you know, just a little bit too much. That's like, nah. And so, you know, the great thing was, is that I had somebody like, you know, Steve Zalian there every minute of every, you know, every second of every take that I did. And so he was always there. Yeah. Steve, the creator and director.
Did he direct all the episodes?
He directed all of them, but one.
Wow.
James Marsh directed episode 4. Yeah. So Steve was, you know, he was captain, and it was a great, you know, he was always there reminding me of that subtlety.
This is why I loved, among the reasons I love Night Of, is so in journalism, and this phrase, I think I heard it before, there was this other HBO show, The Newsroom, and they said, let's present the best arguments of the other side, the best arguments. And that idea, when applied to drama, in a movie, you can't always get it. Sometimes the villain has to twirl a mustache and you have to signal. But this was really the best arguments, if you will, of both sides. It wasn't, we knew the character, the main character was innocent of the crime that he was accused of, or at least we thought we had strong indications that he was innocent. And you had a sympathetic defense lawyer played by Turturro. But your character, they could have made him a lot of things which would have tipped the scale, which would have affected our sympathies, but they and you made him just the best version of that character. And also, it says something more about the system if the motivations of the character trying to put him away aren't called into question, if he's doing the best job he can do as he sees it within the system.
Yeah. No, it just complicates and makes and gives the story a reality which is deeper and more real and sort of not as easy in black and white to live in.
Yeah.
And in the words that Richard wrote and the way that Steve was sort of guiding me, it made it a more difficult and mysterious and challenging, you know, story to, I think, also engaging, obviously.
Yeah.
To participate in.
This is Richard Price, right? The screenwriter.
Yeah, Richard
and
Price.
He did Lush Life, and he's fantastic, but he does ride-alongs with cops. He probably knows more cops than, you know, the chief of police. Did you meet with actual cops? Did he introduce you to any? Was that part of how you got into the role?
I spoke to a couple of homicide cops. I spoke to a homicide detective down at on 10th Street, which I think is the 6th Precinct. And then I spoke to a retired homicide cop who came in, and I, you know, sat at the Edison Diner before it closed with him for a couple of hours and spoke with him.
What were you looking for from those conversations?
I just wanted to hear about their experience, and the thing that I really got from these two guys was, because they were nothing like Dennis Box. Mm-hmm. They were nothing like the guy that was written and created and that I tried to fill the shoes of and live. And yet just the sort of day in and day out experience that it was for somebody that decided to do that with their life was what I really wanted to listen to,
mm-hmm,
and to get an idea. as to that reality.
Well, it seems like the character was really lived in. I mean, the first time you come on the screen, we don't get the sense that, okay, here's a character. It's like he just pulled in. He brings his 25 years or whatever of experience with him. It's all right there. Yeah. In his style of dress, in his mannerisms, in the fact that he's not at all over the top. You know, this is definitely a job that he's done hundreds of times.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the goal.
Yeah.
Was to not make it anything special because this guy has 30 years of experience or, I don't know, over 300 homicides that he's had to investigate.
So do you often talk to, when it's available, do you often talk to a person who walked in the shoes that your character walked in? How big a role does it have to be for you to seek out an actual person to do your research?
It doesn't necessarily have to be large at all. It's something that I learned from a director many years ago as an exercise. It was just something that was part of the process of rehearsing. He suggested to all of us, or actually made us, go and find the professional in the real world that had the same occupation that we were playing, whatever that may be, and spend some time with that person and interview them. And then come back and be interviewed by the rest of the cast and people working on the show as if I was that person. So I had to then kind of live it on my toes with the information that I had already, you know, accrued from some real person. So, you know, as often as I can do that, when I can do that, I do it, and it's, I think, immensely valuable.
Do you remember the first time where it really paid off?
Yeah, it was in San Francisco. I was doing a new play, a premiere of a play called 36 Views, and I was playing an art dealer of ancient Japanese art, right?
Something that, how much did you know about?
Nothing. Right. Absolutely nothing. I think I had like a what I thought was a jade, you know, little sort of circular necklace, you know, that I, you know, thought was cool. And I had to be somebody that was, you know, had spent a lot of time, you know, over at Angkor Wat and, you know, and Thailand and East Asia and knew Chinese history and Japanese history and Edo period art and all sorts of, you know, everything about it. And he was a fraud.
Uh-huh.
He sold, you know, fraudulent art, you know, fakes.
Yeah.
And
so that probably means
so he could travel in all of these different circles, really. And so I went and I found there was a guy who was not that. He was just an expert in Asian art. I went and I spoke to him and it had huge dividends for me. Because it was just something that somehow I was able to kind of put on. It's hard to articulate, but I had information, obviously, that I could fall back onto and use as sort of like a personal history, even though it wasn't my personal history. I could create something.
So what do you do when you're playing Reverend Hale from Beverly in The Crucible? There are no current, you know, anti-witchcraft judges riding the countryside. Who do you talk to?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that was something that I didn't seek anybody out. I did have people in mind that I knew from my past that I thought about.
People from Massachusetts.
Yes.
Maybe people from Beverly.
People from not far from Beverly.
Wow.
People, I grew up in a small town called Groton, Massachusetts, which is not that far from Beverly. And not that far from Salem, really, either. And the school that I ended up attending, because my dad was a faculty member at, it was an Episcopalian school. We had to attend chapel every morning. We had interminable Sunday masses, you know, sit-down dinner, stuff like that. It was one of those schools. So there were five ordained ministers on the faculty or something, you know. And so over the 5 years and the years growing up, there were sort of images and people that I had in mind when I was trying to find, you know, John Hale.
Were they austere?
Well, it was interesting because it was kind of a mishmash because John Hale goes through this tremendous change.
Right.
If only we had more John Hales.
But as I remember it, it's Danforth who is the hard ass, the true strict guy. Who there's really believes it. Right. Yeah. I know this because I hate to brag. I know you got
did you play
for
him?
Tony. I played John Proctor.
Nice.
In the Oceanside High School production. A lot of Long Island accents. I saw Goody Proctor with the devil. A lot of that going on. but the words were great. And, you know, the fact that over the years, they still bring this up. But yes, Hale does go through that transformation. I believe Adam Hess, our John Hale, pulled that off almost as well as you did on Broadway.
I don't know.
Great stones they lay upon his chest. Yeah, I could do the hall.
You are a foolish old man.
It was a bird. I saw a bird with the devil.
I see no birds.
Yeah. Are you ascendant? Are we living in Bill Camp's heyday? You're in 2016?
I don't know.
I mean, are you hotter? Do you sense you're getting more offers than you had 10 years ago?
I don't know. There. Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. No, that's very clear. Yeah, so it's like I had to, you know, I think I had to turn 50 and my face had to go through the Chet Baker, like, transformation.
Yeah.
Some
people are born to play character actors. They're just too good looking when they're young.
No, it's fantastic. No, that was hardly the case. But it's exciting and it's great. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff happening.
I also think there's probably more out there that, like, when you were on Law & Order, were there all these shows that we're seeing, like the HBO shows and the FX series, all these series that will embrace subtlety, that will go tell a long story that unspools over a number of episodes, that don't necessarily have to have characters where immediately you get what they are just by, you know, the way they look. I think it's probably a good time for great actors like you.
Certainly in television.
Yeah.
The only TV I've done is the HBO, you know, Night Of in the last, and Leftovers. I did a bunch of Damages. But movies seem to be the thing that, I don't know, I'm about to do three of them. I just finished two of them. I'm in Loving, that's out now. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff, but mostly movies.
Although, you know, I do find this, and I know you're in The Leftovers and The Night Of. Sometimes it seems like there's almost this HBO repertory theater.
Mm-hmm.
You see the same guys in the same things, but it's probably me convincing myself of that.
No, I think you're accurate. I've noticed that myself. And I've also felt like I'm very happy and pleased if they would like to include me in their repertoire.
Yeah.
In their company.
What if they're resurrecting Sex and the City? You could do that again.
Was that HBO?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I don't know where I'd
like
fit
a
in that.
To me,
I don't know how I'd fit into that.
Samantha's got a new boy toy.
Yeah.
It's a 30-year homicide detective.
That's
doing
right.
A mashup, yeah.
Balding, you know, potbelly, grumpy, you know, with the worst haircut in the history of television.
But in bed, his beastliness isn't so subtle to you. That is my Beth Samantha impersonation. Thank you. So off the realm of playing different characters, you're narrating some hockey content now. Can you tell
yes,
me about that?
Yes. No, I think this is my third year. I think it's my fourth. But yeah, the Road to the Winter Classic, presented by Epix. And Ross Greenberg, you know, producing it in his brilliance. And that is a great privilege to do.
Like life itself, at the very beginning, no one realizes the game will someday feel like such a mystery. That why things happen the way they happen will become so vexing. That hockey is a puzzle everyone is forever trying to solve.
I mean, the whole bench is saying deep. You gotta fucking put it deep.
Play some fucking pride.
Their search for perspective can take them far from their arenas.
This was the night before Christmas.
What did they like about your voice? Did they ever articulate that? Did Ross ever tell you? Is there something about you that sounds hockey?
Really?
No, I don't know.
No.
There's no Canadian-ness to it.
I don't know. I have no idea. I think, you know, it's best for me not to know. And I think probably Ross and Steve and Aaron are aware of that, given all of their, you know, experience, that it's probably best not to tell the talent what they like about it, because then we'll mess it up.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, Bill Camp from HBO's Night Of, and he will be narrating Epics Presents Road to the NHL Outdoor Classics. Thanks a lot, Bill.
You too, Mike. Thank you so much.
And now the spiel. The nation of Saudi Arabia will be, on the new year, doing something it hasn't done. Actually acknowledging it is a new year. 2 months ago, the kingdom dropped the use of the Islamic calendar in the public sphere. And January 1st is the first time they will be celebrating New Year's Day Gregorian style. Now, since the Saudis conduct business internationally, say oil sales, the private sector has long gone with the Gregorian. But now it is the whole country. And civil servants in Saudi Arabia say it's just a huge ploy to rob them of 11 days worth of pay. The Saudi Gregorian calendar is longer, and I gotta say, the Saudi civil servants probably have a point. The Saudi courts, ever the iconoclasts, ever the hardliners, are resisting the move. Now, to my mind, this gives rise to the possibility of a criminal sentenced to, say, 20 years in jail, but if he was sentenced in 1435, he could argue, hey, it's 2017, I have more than served my time. Of course, in Saudi Arabia, you could lose your tongue on appeal. But this got me to thinking about the Gregorian calendar. We live by it, but do we think about it? First of all credit to Pope Gregory XIII. He seems to have been a pretty competent pope. For instance, he had a kid out of wedlock, but only before he took his vows. Pretty good for a pope of that era. And he was better to the Jews than the pope before him. Although, and I read from the Jewish Encyclopedia, Gregory XIII, while showing an occasional leniency, introduced a large number of severe restrictions. The Jews were prohibited from driving through the streets of the city, and they were obliged to send every week at least 150 of their number to listen to the sermons of a conversionist preacher. The terrible custom of keeping Jews in prison for a certain time each year, and of fattening them and forcing them for the amusement of the mob to race during the carnival when mud was thrown at them, is mentioned as an old custom for the first time during Gregory's pontificate. So wait, I guess that means you can't blame it on Gregory. But throwing mud at the fat Jews, as an Italian Jew, I'm not even conflicted. That's fucking horrible. Anyway, Gregory XIII did champion the calendar, which was among the most serious things he did. Indeed, the Gregorian calendar was created via the bull of Inter Gravissimas. And it gets its name, Inter Gravissimas, because it starts with the phrase Inter Gravissimas Pastoralis Officii Nostri Curis, among the most serious, blah, blah, blah. So credit to Gregory XIII. But real credit should be given to Aloysius Lilius. He was the Italian scholar who worked out the Gregorian calendar. He aligned Easter with the vernal equinox. He made some tweaks to daylight saving time that we still use today. So this way, days wouldn't get all out of whack over centuries to come. Therefore, I believe this should be called the Aloysian calendar. Gregorian, there's already the adjective Gregorian. Gregorian chants, though those Gregorians were named after a different Pope Gregory, the first Pope Gregory. But Aloysian, that needs to be an adjective. Another Gregorian calendar note, Britain and the colonies were late adapters to the conversion. Really, really late. It took almost 200 years to get with the program. I guess they stockpiled a bunch of vocab word of the day calendars and didn't want to change them. Oh, what's this word, Harold? Aloysian. Anyway, they, meaning I guess us, the nascent America, waited until 1752 to adopt the Gregorian calendar. Therefore, interesting trivia question. You ready? What signature event happened on September 6th, 1752? The answer? Nothing. Nothing happened then. That date didn't exist in America and Britain. Britain and the colonies skipped from September 2nd all the way to September 14th. September 11th, never forget, except in 1752. You can't remember because it never happened. Aloysius Lilius never knew any of this, of course. He lived in the 1500s, but he also never lived to see the implementation of his calendar under Pope Gregory XIII. That papal bull went into effect in 1582, but Aloysius Lilius ran out of dates in 1576. Or, as they call it in Saudi Arabia, well, as they will up until next Sunday, the year 984. And that's it for today's show. GIST producer Chris Berube will star in the new Netflix season of Sex and the City, The Jimmy Chusable, in which Carrie Miranda and the gang move to Narragansett but are resisted by townspeople who have deemed them to be witches. GIST producer Mary Wilson's favorite episode is when the Reverend Hale falls in love with Goody Charlotte for her wholesomeness and blue blood charm. Executive producer of Slate Podcast Steve Lickteig is partial to the episode in which Samantha gets advice from Tituba because she wants access to Tituba's anti-aging potion. Chief Content Officer of the Panoply Network, Andy Bowers, always wanted to hear the line, "My honesty is broke, Elizabeth. I am no good man." Uttered by Mario Cantone, Sex and the City's Anthony Marantino. The GIST, heady, complex, analytical. We're such a Miranda. Or a Reverend Danforth. Umperu deperu duperu, and thanks for listening.